Good afternoon, good morning, and aloha, everybody. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's quarterly keynote. We are really happy to welcome classes B, C, D, and E to this chance to stretch the imagination and expand our knowledge through listening to an expert on an issue related to social change advocacy. My name is Kata Isari. I will be the moderator for today's call. And just want to remind everybody that the keynote series of the ALC features renowned practitioners, scholars, and activists working on a range of human rights advocacy activities. And we invite these scholars and activists to join us to supplement our knowledge and learning because of their diverse experience and perspectives. Each keynote looks in depth at an issue that informs our social change advocacy from a new perspective. As you all know, today's keynote is titled Social Change Advocacy in Action, the Movement of Farm Worker Women. And our conversation today is with Milly Trevino-Sacida, longtime activist and founder of Lideres Campesinas. Welcome, Milly. We're so happy to have you here on the call today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and being very patient with me this morning.
We're so glad you made it, and we know we're going to have a good conversation together. Before we jump in, I know that people have been chatting with Beth on our public chat, so we want to encourage you to continue doing that. Beth McNamara, Praxis staff person, is going to be the person on the chat. If you have any thoughts, any questions, any ideas that you want to contribute to the conversation, we're going to invite you to do that through the public chat today so that we can hear from you and pass your questions or comments on to Milly for her response. Tilly, Beth, and Liz, in addition to backing us up, will also be participating in the chat and adding their comments or thoughts or questions. Now, let's move on and meet Milly Trevino-Sacida and hear a little bit more about Milly and a lot more about her work with Lideres Campesinas, which is a wonderful example of social change advocacy in action. Milly, again, we're so honored to have you on this call and appreciate you taking the time to be with us. I wonder if we could start off by having you tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to do this work.
Well, thank you. To start again, thank you for your patience. Thank everybody that are on this presentation, on this call, webinar. It's an experience for me, and at the same time, I know Tilly and Kata have been very, very patient with me. So I want to start now by saying I do come from a migrant farm worker background, and because as migrants, we had to work as children in the agricultural fields. It was hard work, but at the same time, harder it was knowing that the wages were not that great. So at the same time, where we lived and where we worked, there were places where it could be only several of us as families that were Latinos, and at the same time we hardly had any way of communication. My background, as I was saying, it is coming from working, doing this kind of labor, and many people that I know that come from this background have done wonderful work, and at the same time, I do admire that they were able to do many things for them and for themselves and their families, because as I grew up, as you see in the picture, there, I'm around like 22, 23 years old. I had had my son by then. I had been married and had my son, and my husband and I could not even have enough in terms of working full time and many more than 10 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week, and we could hardly make it. The situation with us, it wasn't just that it was hard labor, low wages, other issues within the workplace. And as a woman, I went through so much. I saw my mother going through so much. She had miscarriages during the work. Many, many other issues that I was able to see throughout my life. And it just made me very angry because I knew it was wrong. But many of us did not know we had rights until we did find about the UFW, the United Farm Workers, and we were able to start learning about helping ourselves exercise our rights. But sooner than later, we were fired because we were doing some of that. We were not doing it the right way. But ended up that some of us were involved a little bit closer with the United Farm Workers. At the same time, we did see that there were rights for workers, but I also saw there were not that many rights for women issues. I mean, I didn't see it in that sense, but I did see that there were certain things that we as women were going through, like harassment in the workplace, the field sanitation, there were no toilets, many other things that were not considered at all. Maybe because as women we were not necessarily, we didn't know we could speak up at some of these meetings, but sooner than later we started thinking about the importance of talking, and when we would do that, it was not seen in a way that it was appropriate. So it's a long history in terms of why I got involved and why it went up to leading to organizing a movement of pharmacowomen.
Yeah, so Millie, let me jump in. And it sounds like you're describing how Lideras Campesinas got started. Can you tell us specifically what made you decide to do that, to start this group in California?
Yes. First of all, there was a needs assessment. I was, by then, this is late 80s, I was working with the California Rural Legal Assistance. Because I had been very vocal in the agricultural fields and doing all that work, I ended up being hired to be kind of like a community worker liaison. And someone close to my family was interested in working on her thesis, and it was doing a needs assessment of pharmacowomen. It was interesting because I had already been involved publicly organizing farm workers and organizing within the community and organizing on the educational setting, but I had not been able to work directly with women as before that needs assessment. And the needs assessment was to find out the issues and problems of farm worker women and at the same time find out what they thought needed to be done. And believe me, that was a great turnaround for me because I had been providing service for like 7 years already, thinking that giving people the information about their rights, where they could go, programs, etc., was enough. And I started finding out that many people, even though I was giving them their information, something was wrong. Something was not clicking. I wasn't doing something right, but I didn't understand. Until we did that needs assessment, I was able to interview a little bit more than 30 women. And most of these women, as they talked about their issues, about their problems, and I'm talking about domestic violence, about worker issues, about their children's issues in the school district, about even going to access for services, and there a lot of disparities there, and bad treatment, which I also went through that at certain point in time when I was a farm worker. So at the end of that needs assessment, the women actually were able to share what they thought needed to happen. And it's interesting because you think that a lot of times you know more than the people because you've been involved and you have a lot, you're exposed more in a wider arena. And what I started learning from the women is that they were saying, if I would have more information, or if I would be able to meet with other women, or if I would be part of a group or something that could support, or if, I mean, none of them were saying if there would be more programs, none of them, it was so interesting. I learned that I needed to listen to them, and I learned that I needed to really understand that if I would be there and I had all this expertise in terms of giving them the information about their rights, that I also needed to understand, well, it's about giving them their information, but that doesn't mean that what I give them is what they need. So that was a change. It was a strong change for me. So I started convincing some of the other interviewers and the women that also helped me, which we were part of this needs assessment, the group of women, we continued meeting, and I was able to convince this group, a small group of seven, and convince them to form a group and start inviting women from those areas where we had done the interviews. And because it was anonymous and because I couldn't say who I interviewed, but I was able to see a good number of women coming and to those meetings. And it's interesting because some of these women that I interviewed are still part of this movement that we created. So by listening to them to talk about their issues and then talk about that they needed to also do something, that's what really triggered, you know, it's about us trying to create change. It's not about us waiting for someone else to take care of us.
That's a really fascinating statement you just made, Millie. It's about us trying to create change instead of waiting for someone else to take care of us. Tell me a little bit more about what is it specifically that you heard from the women that led you to decide to create this kind of approach through collective action and organizing.
Well, when we started, when we were leafleting, as I said, and we started meeting, it was very interesting because we were so excited about talking and sharing issues. And some of the women were already volunteering at the schools. They were already helping out at the church. They were doing something. These women were not necessarily, I want to go to this group and see what I can get from the group. It was, I want to come to this group, and as we talk, I don't want to just talk. I want to really make a difference. I want to find what else is there, and if we could together do something. We had no idea what we could do. We just knew many of us were doing volunteer work, were activists, wanted to help out, were smart. We were daring at times. We would do complaints, and some of the women were also interested in filing complaints because they started finding out that they had the right to, as in terms of gender issues, they had the right to earn the same or even better as their male peers that were at the workplace. Some of them were finding out that they were working there. Because they were working there like 20 years in the workplace, and some of the male were working like 10 or 12 years, they were getting more pay and more hours. So as we started sharing that information, we started guiding each other. And by guiding each other, we found out, you know what, we can maybe as we're doing this, and we would go and support and accompany each other. And maybe not the whole group, but some of us would go and accompany each other and support each other and learn from that and bring it back to the group. That's how we started. That's how we learned that we could make a difference. And then finding out that we could also get involved in politics, we got people that we were angry at because they didn't want to build housing for farm workers for our families. They didn't want to, the school district did not want to pay attention for what was going on with our children. There was a lot of violence at school. There was a lot of pregnancy. There were a lot of just issues with drugs and alcohol within the school system. And so what we did is that we continued getting together, and the women said, yes, even though some of us don't know how to read and write, the ones that do can accompany, and we can go and convince people to register to vote. And we did a whole campaign. Everything we did on our own, not knowing that there were other groups, and then other groups were kind of like finding out that, what was this group doing? Or were we trying to do the right thing? And we knew we were doing the right thing, to the point that we got the people that were elected, the ones that were able to approve for housing, they were able to name a first school, Cesar Chavez, which is, he was our hero during that time and continue being, because he was the one that helped us understand that we had rights and we could go from there. So we started that way, you know, in terms of organizing and talking and understanding that we could make a difference. Yes, it mattered that some of us maybe did not go to high school or even, you know, grade school, but we were smart. We had so many ideas, and we could share that, and we were finding out we could respect that and work as a collective.
Well, it sounds like you, it's very inspiring to hear the way that you connected with the women. And obviously there was a range of different women from what you've described that were participating in these groups. And one of the things I think you know, Millie, that we talk a lot about in the Advocacy Learning Center is the importance of connecting with women in their true life experiences and understanding the full range of the complexity of what faces with them. And I'm wondering, how did you find ways to bridge the differences amongst women and help everyone feel included and part of this collective approach?
Oh, it was not easy to start with, because at times I think, see, some of them thought, I had not even had high school during that time, and some of them thought that because I would share some of the experiences that I had had with the United Farm Workers and then with this agency, and then some of the women also shared what they were doing. It was kind of like we had to meet in, as bell hooks talks, let's meet at the center. This is not about leaving anybody outside. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to learn little by little. It's not about who knows more. It's about who is more reasonable and what are the issues, and can we focus on if we are working collectively. How are we going to be able to not only work collectively, but find ways that are going to support to create the change? For example, in terms of convincing the school board to build housing, it wasn't just, oh, let's go to the school board. We put together some questionnaires and work with this agency that was interested in building housing for farm workers, and we sat with them and blah, blah, blah. It was a whole, you know, steps for doing those things. But as the women, some of them who felt that, oh, well, you know, I can't read or write, but we would encourage them, you know, this is not about having to read or write. It's important that you read information so that you know what, you know, you're getting on the mail or whatever, but it's also very important in terms of your experience. You've been part of the Parent Advisory Committee, and you've been making sure that children in the school are getting the right kind of education, or some of them were saying they were part of the United Farm Workers, you know, organizing workers or whatever. And you know, it took us several months by convincing each other that, and working together, and then validating each other that what we were doing and what we were being successful with and what we were not being successful, how could we do it better? Because maybe some of us thought we knew the right thing, but then we would learn that the ones that weren't talking at the beginning were giving us greater ideas. So it was kind of like, you know, like a mix of different things that were happening at the same time. But it did take, and it continues being that within the movement. As women join, it's not about them at the beginning feeling, oh yeah, I'm part of this group or I am part of Líderes Campesinas and this is why. No, it takes them some while, but at the same time we try to validate with exercises or different trainings that help the participants understand there's more than just being a professional, because they think that organizers, in the past, people thought that community leaders were just people that are public officials, executives, professionals, you know, people like that. And as soon as they started understanding that they were also leaders, This is why they named Líderes Campesinas, Líderes Campesinas, farmer girl women leaders. It's because they started understanding, you know, we take initiative, we have all these characteristics of a leader. So let's in a collective, it can become even more powerful. And in watching and sharing what were the issues is what has kept us together. And as the women said, let's do this around the state of California. We had no money to do that. At the same time, when we only had $8,000 for a full year to go around the state of California and invite women to see if we could organize the same way we organized in that valley, Coachella Valley in Southern California. And because we had made a lot of difference in that community, we thought we could invite women to do the same thing. And we did another needs assessment, and we did many other things. And as we started traveling around rural California, we only had money for gas and sometimes food. And well, the women knew that we only had money for gas. We didn't have any place to stay. We would travel starting on a Friday. And before doing the week, I would make my calls and work with community workers that I knew from California Rural Legal Assistance, which is a statewide agency that I had been working with, see if the workers there, community workers also, could help me out in terms of getting women that they knew that were already active and were interested in replicating some of the work that we were doing in the Coachella Valley. Well, I traveled the first 6 months. I ended up traveling like 20-some communities. And we would start on a Friday and have a meeting on a Friday evening, and then on a Saturday evening in another community, and the same thing would happen either in the afternoon, and then in the evening, late evening on the Saturday, and then Sunday in the morning, and then Sunday afternoon, trying to have meetings kind of coming back, so that by the time we finished the last meeting, we were practically maybe an hour and a half or 2 hours away or 3 hours away from home. As we did that, it was interesting because some of the women wanted to join me, go to these meetings, to these other meetings when I was going north, because they knew that on my way back I could take them back home. And we would end up staying at people's homes. Most of them were the members' homes, or people that I already knew from throughout California. We would stay. The women would feed us. And we're talking about women that only earn during that time, we're earning like between $5,000 and $7,000 a year. And the women would feed us. Or we would say, don't worry, we only want tortillas, don't worry about that. And I mean, they would make a whole meal. But why? Because they knew that what we were doing was going to be something that they felt, and they kept telling us, You're doing something that no one else is doing with us. So we want to make sure you're not only fed, but that you're going to be able to continue, and we want to accompany you. And I had many women accompany throughout the rest of the year, to the point that we formed a statewide advisory committee.
Okay, so Millie, I'm going to jump in, and you clearly you had a lot of dedicated people that when women that were connected to what you did. And I know that you did a lot of different types of activities as a part of your work, and we're looking at a slide now that shows some of the creative work that you used as a way to communicate your issues out. Can you tell us a little bit about that creative approach, using the creative arts as a part of your work, and how that was useful in your mobilizing?
Yes. As we started, of course, before that we had the convenings, but the way we knew that we were going to be able to best communicate with the women, it wasn't about lecturing, and it wasn't just about, you know, having a dialogue with each other. It was about talking about the issues, but giving examples with using theatrical skits. This about theatrical skits, it comes from with our own, within our own communities, either through religion or our indigenous communities. There's a lot of theater that happens, and the majority of the time to present something, you do a lot of role play. So the women, in order for them to talk about certain issues, they for example, if they were, wanted to talk about the field sanitation, the pesticides, the lack of drinking water, the bad, you know, minimum wages that were not even paid, or non-payment of wages, the harassment, they would do a skit or, different scenes within a skit that would portray that. And let me tell you, the women did not have something in writing. They would like 15 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour before, they would get prepared, and they would, because they already knew the subject, they knew because they had gone through all these issues, they would share that, and then they would explain how a scene would be, and they would present it in front of people. And then the women would ask, some of them would ask the rest of the participants that were there, can you tell me what you saw? And as they were asking, the women were sharing, and that helped the women not need to necessarily have to feel that they needed to share what was going on with them if they didn't feel trust at the beginning, but they could share what they saw, but then we could talk about, well, these are some of the rights that you have, blah, 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 or we would bring experts from agencies that could come and looking at the skid, give them the information that they needed. That was the kind of communication that we were doing, and the women really liked it. And more in each area wanted to be the actresses because they also wanted to present the issues or what they had lived as an experience or what they knew their coworkers were going through.
So it was a way of making visible their experiences and bringing
That's right.
it to the forefront for them. And what about the artwork that we see on this slide? Can you tell us?
The artwork ended up happening a little bit later. What the women started finding out, I don't know if people know about the Bandana Project with Southern Poverty Law Center, Esperanza Project. And this is women. This is Monica Ramirez working with this. She's an attorney that had been involved with the project is in general about sexual harassment in the workplace with pharmaco women and sexual assault. And we worked with her since 2007, and we found out that as women started drawing on the bandanas, is as you can see in the picture on the top, there are some women covering their faces. It's not just covering their faces because of the dust or the pesticides or the wind or the dirt. It also is to cover themselves so people, you know, the perpetrators could not see who they were. And big shirts also are used, and even something that would cover your buttocks so as you bend down, you're not seen, et cetera, et cetera. So it's basically issues that happen in our community, and the bandana would be talking, having women share about what was going on with sexual harassment in the workplace. And then we would go, the women would draw on them and do not only a design, but give a message around the issue, but then we would, in each community, we would try to see if we could get around 30 or more of the women to draw. And some of them started crocheting them and, you know, doing their artwork, very beautiful work. And then we would exhibit them outside and publicly, either outside of the churches or outside in the malls, or even going to the agencies outside where people we knew that, like for the Employment Development Department, we knew that people were going to be waiting, or the health clinics. We would do the exhibits and ask people to even vote for which one was the best one, so that they could take a look at each one. And contests like that would serve as making sure that people were paying attention to the drawings and what all that meant. And the same thing we did with domestic violence. In October, the women are given the patterns of little aprons, They design and talk about how to prevent domestic violence or what are the issues with domestic violence that are going on in their community, and we do exhibits. And even there's even competitions within the different groups. Who does more exhibits? Who has more people come into the exhibits? Who did the best, the best drawing? Who did the best message? All these. And at the same time, we're building awareness, and it's fascinating. We do that, the same thing, artwork with other issues that we have. It's not just domestic violence or sexual harassment. It's the other issues that I talked before.
That's a very innovative way to raise both awareness in the community but also amongst the women and connect the women to each other. I wonder, how did you decide and plan what was going to happen and what issue you were going to focus on?
Well, as you see here on the picture, this is a convening already with Indigenous women, but before we had in 1993 and 1994, we had formed an advisory committee of women throughout of the groups that we had organized, and the representative, two people from each committee, it was a representative and an alternate, would come and were part of that advisory committee. It was a statewide advisory committee. And the advisory committee was the one that was giving us guidance in terms of we're getting women together, and you're all saying, we want to do change. We want to take action. We just don't want to talk about our issues. We want to, you know, we don't only want to give recommendations. We want to take action ourselves. What can we do, and how can we do it together? So that advisory committee was formed, and they were the ones that decided that convenings, getting together women from all over the state, inviting them to be part of a day and a half, 2 days and a half, and where we would have workshops. And workshops were not to come in and just listen. Workshops were so that we could open dialogue about the different issues. For example, there would be a workshop on domestic violence. There would be a workshop on sexual harassment in the workplace, on childcare, et cetera, et cetera. And each workshop, the women, you would give a kind of like a presentation, not to give them information, but to open the dialogue, what that topic was going to be about, and how we would need to be respectful so that everybody could be sharing. And that meant we were having like four workshops at the same time. So we were having like 150, 200 women at the convening. They were divided in four different groups, and each group would be talking about an issue and then giving recommendations. And then those documents would serve as a platform in terms of where we would be taking this project. And the first convening was in 93, and then in 94, the women decided we needed to become an entity where we could directly fundraise and get money so that we can be trained on the issues and then be able to network with other agencies and see in how can we make a difference? How can we together, not just as pharmaco women, but with agencies or advocates that are out there trying to do good service, and maybe they need our support, building trust in the community, et cetera. And then we started inviting at the other convenings, which the third one happened in the year 2000, and then 2002 and 2004. The one that you're seeing in 2004, the group of women that are on the top, that was at the very end, and you all know that the majority of the time at the very end, only like half of the group is there. So you can see it's a half of the group of all the women that were there in 2004. But the women were talking. It wasn't just about talking, and it wasn't just about, oh, we want to be trained and then we're going to disseminate our information locally. It's about in what way we can also become involved with advocacy. Right now they're also involved with working with different organizations and groups where they also go and talk to public officials. The woman in red that's down there, she's an assembly member, and she speaks always very highly of about the organization. She's being recognized because she had been working with the organization for several years already, first locally as council member, and then as an assembly member. And the same thing would be happening throughout 12 different chapters that we organized at Farmaco Women. Mm-hmm. So imagine women getting together, being part of an advisory committee, organizing all these events, and then locally organizing their every month they organize two events, either at home or they do a public presentation, at a hall, or go and do a site visit with a service provider, trying to build connections with agencies and organizations because they want to be visible. They want to make sure that people understand they're there. They can become the liaison between the community and the public service because we want to make sure that the public service provides service in places where there's no representation, et cetera, et cetera. So there's many things. Even the younger generation started joining us. And
before we move on to thinking about the youth organizing, this thing that you described about how the workshops were dialogues and not presentations, we talk a lot in the Advocacy Learning Center about developing dialogue and doing dialogue instead of just telling people or filling people's minds up with information. So I wonder if you could tell us more about how did you do that in these workshops to make it be about dialogue and not just one person standing up giving information to the rest.
Okay, we had to do this. We had to do this since the first convening. There was an agreement where it wasn't about bringing professionals to come and lecture. The women that come to these events are women that are already volunteers, not necessarily know all the statistics, not necessarily were trained on the subject, but knew about the issues. And what they wanted was to make sure that in those workshops, it was the facilitator that was chosen were women themselves from the advisory committee. They committed in terms of we helped them get prepared in terms of how to facilitate to make sure that everybody would have a chance to speak and that there was always someone to have that would be taking the time, someone that takes the time to make sure that, you know, it's you're running out of time, you're going to have to, you need to make sure we're going to have recommendations from this group, blah, blah, blah. So it's about, we prepared before. It wasn't just going to the event and getting the women and then dividing them there. No, everything was prepared. And we're talking about these women being very savvy, in terms of saying, okay, well, yeah, we're going to talk about sexual harassment or we're going to talk about domestic violence. In this session, what we want to do is make sure that, it's not only about talking about what is the cycle of violence. We want to talk about what are the different issues that you go through or you've seen. Have you been a victim or what? Or are you a survivor and share that? And have you gone to agencies and have they helped you? What have all these issues were shared? And then we would work it out where they could give us recommendations. And this is where they came out saying, well, we need to be trained. We need to be trained by experts, but to train us as trainers so we can train our community because we need to also make sure that experts understand how we talk, what are our terms, how is it that we can communicate because we don't want to be just lectured also and using theater at the same time. So
it was really a way to hear from the women about their experiences and what they wanted before you told them about the issues that they were facing.
Yes, it was the women who decided what were the issues that they thought we needed to bring to the convening, And then this advisory committee, it's all Farmaco women, and they were coming from the chapters that they were representing. So that meant that I had to be working with each chapter that they had formed and find out, what were the different issues. And then they were trusting that the advisory committee would decide what were the priority issues that we needed to work with, because the first convening we could only talk about 12 different issues. The second convening we ended up talking about, I think it was 18, because it was a longer, there were more days within the convening. And then the rest of the convenings, they were done in a very, kind of like a little different way, where the women could, everything was organized in that way. I mean, we're, for us, it's a given because it's Farmaco women who have been the organizers, who had been at the beginning the advisors, and then in 96, as it shows there in the board of, that's when they became board of directors, representing the 12 chapters. That meant that by then they wanted us to work with becoming an entity, so that we could be the ones fundraising and getting money that we could basically be able to use to train the women and to have for materials and to be able to transport around and bring women together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And how did the word get out about the chapters and the convenings? How did you throughout rural California make those connections with women to let them know about these opportunities?
At the beginning, it was with California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation. They were the group that we had in the Coachella Valley. Remember I said I was working for this legal services?
Yeah.
It's California Rural Legal Assistance. I was a community worker. And during the time, that smaller group was called Mujeres Mexicanas, Mexican Women. That group was the group in pioneer group that helped, for Líderes Campesinas later to evolve and throughout the state. But what happened there is that, because they were already supporting us with certain conferences that we were organizing locally in the Coachella Valley in 88 through 91, every year we would organize one. And in 1991, we decided we wanted to do, share this in other places, as I said, that we wanted to see if women in other regions around rural California were interested in doing what we were doing. What we did is go to the California Rural Legal Assistance Foundation, and they became our fiscal agent. We were kind of like a small project, but this project, it needed to spin off because we were growing very, very fast. They thought it was going to be just a project where we would get the women together and train them, and women would be happy, and then they would just give out information. Things were just going to, to tell you the truth, they thought we were only going to have like 3 groups around California. And we ended up organizing 12.
Yeah.
And then the women said, we want a convening. And they never thought we were going to have a convening. So it just grew. It took us 3 years to become an entity and spin off from the fiscal agent, because we were afraid that we were not going to make it. We had no whatsoever experience in terms of doing this, and we never knew that we were going to be able to really form an entity, and we didn't even know we were building a movement. And by the time in 96, we were already sure that we were going to build a movement, and we were going to make sure that, because by 96, we were already connecting with women in other states. You see here economic development and the youth, but here economic development projects is that I was hired in 1997 as the executive director, and I was laughing when the board told me that they wanted me to be the director. I had gone back to school. By then I was already earning my bachelor's, and it's interesting because when I was going to school, and I missed that part in terms of between 91, I moved out of the Coachella Valley and went to school, and finished my AA and then finished with my bachelor's with honors and the whole thing, and I would bring them back to the women, et cetera, et cetera. But then when I was going to graduate in 97, and they hired me as a director, and I said, wait a minute, I didn't go to school to be an administrator or be a director. And then the women said, well, because you've been trusting us and you have helped us trust that we are leaders. We believe that you are a leader that can take this mission. This is when they started calling it this movement. And oh man, they brought me to tears, and we were like, oh my goodness, these women don't know what they're doing. But well, okay, well, we challenged ourselves and we said we were going to do it. So then I challenged the board and said, I am going to start hiring the pharmacowomen members who really are committed and want to be trained to be outreach workers, specialists, coordinators, director of programs, do administration work, et cetera, et cetera. And we started doing that.
And so what made you decide to do the economic development trainings? What were those?
The economic development trainings were hiring the women and train them on the job.
Oh. So they were.
And as we trained them on the job, these women are already volunteers. They knew how to, by then they had been members with us. They knew how to organize, but then as we say training is train them to be a little bit more in terms of following certain steps as an employee, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they have continued being who they are. It's about them. I'm talking about women that never used computers, didn't even finish grade school, and are using computers, internet, and they know how to use the webinar better than I right now.
So they were very successful. And what about your youth organizing? You mentioned that before.
These are the girls that are either the daughters, nieces, or granddaughters of the members that said, hey, wait a minute, this is since 1994. In 98, it was when we were able to have funding for, in 97, and then 98, we started having also convenings for them, trainings for them. And the girls have been participating with the women, but they said, we want our space. We want to talk about our issues, starting with date violence. We want to talk about child labor. We want to talk about, you know, issues that are more related to them. At the same time, they do double shift because they're involved with their own issues and they're involved with the women's issues. And so they have a statewide advisory committee. And then, being smart as they are, they knew that there was a board who had approved for a program for them. And they said, well, they went to the board one of these times, and they said, we want to be on the board. And so the board had to approve for them to have a vote on the board. So their statewide advisory committee, they have nine chapters. Those chapters are part of the different groups that are from the same chapters of the women, but they're adolescents, girls that are talking about their own issues, and they also bring that to the table when they have their board meetings.
That's very smart of them to ask for a place on the board so that they had a role there too.
And the indigenous women, the same thing. They did the same thing.
And so this was a group of women that wanted to become part of Lideras Campesinas?
Well, what happened is that you see different pictures. They're all from different chapters, okay? Uh-huh. And these women started telling us, oh, everything that you're doing is great. We like this. But a lot of things we don't understand because their first language is not Spanish. So what we did is created... working with them. They have an advisory committee of indigenous women, and we work with them so to create trainings where they were trained, but they were trained by other organizations that are indigenous organizations, and now they're trainers, and now they trained their constituents.
So they have kind of sub-chapters within the chapter?
Yes. Well, they're within the same, but they also make sure that they have their own either meetings or they have within the meetings in general, they get to talk about their issues. And it's part of the whole agenda. You know, it's the same. You know, it's not necessarily how the youth have it. It's because the women feel kind of like they want to be part of all the trainings. They want to be part of, they come to the trainings in general with the pharmacowomen, and they also have their own trainings. So they want to have part of both.
Now, I've heard you say, Millie, that, you know, clearly what you're doing is collective action and organizing and mobilizing at a grassroots level, which we talk a lot about in the ALC, and it's not providing services to these women. And I know from hearing you talk before that you have found ways to connect with social service providers to make sure that they were responding to the farm worker women's needs. Can you tell us more about how you built those collaborations and with groups in the community?
Well, If you think it was hard to organize pharmacy women, it was harder to build those networks with some of the agencies.
Mm-hmm.
In California, we still have many organizations, many women shelters, agencies that feel that they're already providing the service to our community, and we as an entity, you know, we know that that's not necessarily happening. And what we started doing was inviting them to some trainings, and only one or two or maybe three people that were our friends would come from those agencies, advocates, Latinas, and we started finding out that it wasn't going to work that way. So what we decided were two things. One was to talk because we, in 1996, we actually convinced the state to place a program that would be called Pharmacowomen Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence. It's the only state in the whole nation that has a program like that. And that comes from the state. And every year, every 3 years you compete, but because we're a statewide entity, we're able to get funding to do the work around the 12. And right now, it's the Líderes Campesinas is organizing three more chapters. And what we ended up doing it in every single area, we would find some kind of resistance. Maybe we started understanding that they felt kind of like, If we were trying to tell them that they didn't know how to do their work or something must have happened. But what we started doing that worked better was ask the state to help us do regional meetings so that we start connecting. And we did that in 98, 99. And then in year 2003, we decided that we were going to invite experts from the different agencies. We were going to have a training on domestic violence. We would invite the experts to come and share their to come and be part of the sessions. And before we would prepare for 3 or 4 months. And within every time we would meet for an hour and a half to 2 hours or even 3 hours and decide how we were going to do the curriculum, the training, the whole using the terms, the methods that they use maybe were not necessarily, we were not saying they were not the adequate ones, but we would ask them to come and do kind of like a mock training before the training so that we could listen to the words that they were using, the terminology, the material, the visuals, everything. And then we would at the same time bring some of our members, and our members would always be raising their hands saying, can you use this word, or can, instead of using the PowerPoint, can we use a theater skit? Can we do this? We would have this kind of connections. And we were building that trust with the agencies to the point that they started understanding, wow, this is a better way, and they were feeling that the women were asking them to come to their meetings to give presentations when in the past it was kind of hard for the women to feel that a certain agency could do a good job in terms of giving them the information. So it was kind of hard. It took us several years, but right now we've done a good job to the agencies now approach, and they've done a good job in terms of working with us, building networks and building that kind of collective also.
So it was a gradual process of change and engaging them.
Yes, it took us some time, yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, isn't it, that it was harder to actually organize with those organizations than it was to connect with the farm worker women. And so reflects that you really started with the needs of the farm worker women and went from there in your work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you look back on all the organizing and work that you've done with Lourdes Campesinas, Millie, are there things that you think that you would do differently or particular successes that stand out for you?
I think at the beginning what we did is that we took a lot of information for the trainings that did not belong to how the women are doing it. And I think that would have been a little bit better if we would have looked at the material and then work with that and adapt whatever would be, you know, within the cultural context of our participants or our members. And I think we were hurrying it up. And because this is why I'm saying that, I could say around 2001, we started understanding that even the indigenous women were telling us, you know, the term domestic violence is not a transfer. You know, you can't translate that word in Spanish. And even in Spanish, you're using the word violencia doméstica, but that's a word that it's not common. It's been used more, but it's not necessarily common within our community. So at times when we would use certain terms or even the power and control wheel, some of the women would look at it, and you know how it looks like a wheel? The wheel, it's a wheel, you know? But the women would look at that, and many of them that didn't know how to read or write, they were understanding it was something different. And so it's, for us, organizing it in a hurry, maybe I would have done a little bit different in terms of taking a little bit longer. But, you know, you never know if it would have worked also. But I know what's worked right now is what really has worked is that the women themselves are the ones that make the decisions. The women themselves, within the board of directors, there's committees of the board. So the committees of the board are like the finance committee, the trainings committee, evaluations committee, all sorts of committees, fundraising committee. The women get involved. And the women, when they have board meetings, each chapter sends a whole document of 3 pages of all the activism within the last 3 months. And this is a connection that, I mean, I've never seen in another place. You know, of pharmaceutical women doing this. And for me, I come from that background. I was hired to work for legal services as a farm worker. They believed in me, and I believed in what they're doing and I believe in their leadership. These are the women that talk. I mean, they're the ones that say, these are our issues. And for them, even if we don't have funding at times for a particular issue, the women say, for us, yes, we need money to do the training, but all these issues and problems, it's about our lives. So we have to continue organizing. So this was has kept our organization alive, our movement. Now, this is why they call it movement.
Well, Millie, that's interesting because we just got a question on the chat that I want to ask you, which relates to what you just described, which is, did you find at any time that you lost momentum in the organizing of the women? And if so, what did you do to re-energize the group and keep them motivated to build and maintain such a strong collective?
When I was saying we grew very fast, we were, and let me tell you, I'm going to be very quick. Between 98 and 1998, we had already received several national recognitions, okay? And so funders come to you. Believe me, I didn't know how to fundraise since the beginning. So funders were coming to us, and we were accepting the funding because it was related to what we wanted. But because we were getting a lot of money, right now I see it's not a lot of money, but a lot of money that we didn't know how to manage. I had to sit down and work on managing it, and I work with someone to help me start hiring, how we started hiring pharmacal women, and it got out of hand a little bit, and people got out of focus. So there is where, by 2004, we started having a lot of issues. What the board did was reorganize and started reorganizing the different committees, and it took us 2 years to rebuild the organization and make sure that everybody was focusing on what is the mission of the organization, which is to make sure that we are enhancing, developing leadership among pharmacal women, so they be the agents of change. And for them to be really focused, it took us a long time. I call it a long time because of how we knew there were certain issues we needed to focus with. But at the same time, the women were working on the issues, were working on making sure that they were supporting each other. And it was hard, but it was worth it, because we know this movement is not going to end, because we've gone through so much. At the same time.
Well, it sounds like you really stayed connected to the roots of the experiences of farm worker women, and it looks like over time that if there was a drift from what you just described, then you took yourself back to what your roots were and where you started and kept your focus on that. Is that a correct summary of that?
Yes, we started talking about, well, why are we here? What's this movement about? And it was about what the mission states, you know, in terms of building, supporting women to be the agents of change. So everybody's, wow, let's go back and let's do it. And it did take us some time, but it was worth it, you know.
You've certainly accomplished so much, because now I understand that you're branching out nationally and maybe internationally.
Yes. We've been working with women throughout these years in other states, and maybe some of them have already incorporated, building their own, you know, chapters. Right now, we're organizing. There's already a group where we have invited women that represent some of these groups that we helped organize, and some others that we're learning from that are working directly with pharmacal women. And we are looking forward to a convening in Washington, D.C. to go and talk to public officials about women being visible, the issues of women, and their recommendations.
Very exciting. It also sounds like you kept your sights on the long-term vision, that it was something that you addressed immediate issues, but that I hear a lot of patience in taking the time that it was needed to get the work done and to go through these processes. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, let me explain this very short. When I say short, you know how I talk long, huh? In the late 90s, we were already working with domestic violence issues. We knew about the Violence Against Women Act, that those were the trainings, the Violence Against Women Act. And between 2000 and between 94, when it was passed, to the reauthorization, Líderes Campesinas got involved in sharing with people from Legal Momentum, who were also very much entrenched with what was going on with the Violence Against Women Act. And we pushed for better sections that would represent pharmacal women, especially immigrant women, because many of our women were not being represented by the Violence Against Women Act. So we worked there, and we've been asked by other groups to also join at a national level. So we were representing at a national level on their boards or task forces, et cetera, et cetera. But to right now, as we say, we're going to become national. It's a group that's saying we want to be represented by these groups that are in the local areas. It's not going to be an entity that's going to say it's a national entity. It's going to be a membership-based national organization.
Now, as we come to the end of our time together, Millie, I wonder if there's any word of encouragement or final thought that you want to leave with our participants, most of whom do domestic violence and sexual assault work, some in rural areas, some with farm worker women, but with a whole range of issues that they face. Any final thoughts that you want to share with them as we think about wrapping up our time?
There's many women, not only immigrant women that work in the agricultural fields, there's women in different parts everywhere that you might think that they're not necessarily outgoing. They might come to you because they need your support, but they have, and you might have already seen that, and they have all sorts of talents and all sorts of skills that they could be your, if you're already having them as volunteers, maybe because in the near future we're organizing nationally, if they can get connected, wow, I mean, I'm doing kind of an advertising here, but at the same time, I truly believe that if you have your local networks as an agency, or as an advocate, if you have your local networks and have volunteers that are supporting you, that can build that trust, it's a great way of really understanding if you're responding within the cultural context of that community. And if you're doing that, people are going to come to you, and then they're not necessarily, if they don't keep coming to you, two things might be happening. Either you're not known or you're doing a very good job the service that they receive now, they're sharing it with others and et cetera, but they might be referring other people. But I truly believe because we've organized in other states, and women are interested. They're interested in getting together, learning and sharing and volunteering and helping out and be their liaisons, and they can help build that trust.
That is really so important for us to remember, and certainly inspiring words to end what's been just a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much, Millie. You've really, I think, helped to challenge us to think in new ways and expand and grow in our understanding of social change advocacy and what it means to be mobilizing with communities of women. I don't know, because you've been so intent on what you've had to say, if you've noticed that there's been a lot of comments in the chat of people appreciating and sharing how much they've learned from listening to you talk. So thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts and your experiences with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think the best way that we can end our call today is to read a few of the comments on the chat to Millie that say, Millie, you're inspirational. You're awesome. Thank you. Goodbye, everybody. The call is now over.